Yeah, if you're not aware, the Culvers have been missionaries with their church for over 30 years with international students. And yeah, every year they come and visit this class with about 30 to 40 international students. And I remember 26 years ago, they brought me out to Florida to talk to 800 graduate students and professors from mainland China. And we saw one-third of the graduate students come to Christ and 50% of the faculty come to Christ. So that's the ministry of the Culvers. And yeah, their bus had a breakdown. They may not make it to class. If they see a bunch of students coming in, then you'll know what's happening. So first of all, I want to thank all of you for the great reception you gave to our visiting scholar at Reasons to Believe, A.J. Roberts. She came here and spoke on viruses. And what she told me was she got the best feedback ever for that talk on viruses. She significantly improved the talk based on the comments you gave her. We got to hear her talk just a couple of days ago at Reasons to Believe. And it's a phenomenal talk on how God has designed viruses to serve us all. So viruses are good things. And we recorded the message, so if you missed it, you'll be able to get that. I wasn't here last week because Kathy and I were in Toronto for some TV interviews, and it was early June, so I got to introduce my wife to Canada's national bird, which is a mosquito. So Kathy's been suffering. She's still got welts all over her body. But it was a wonderful time, and we got to do one hike while we were up there. And got to see a wolverine. And you know, wolverines are solitary animals, and they need 100 square miles of territory. So most people, even in Canada, have never seen a wolverine. Kathy got to see a wolverine. And this little thing just came right out in front of us and stood there and looked at us. So it was great. And you also got to see another extremely rare animal up there. It's called the Mississauga rattlesnake. And they're harmless unless you step on them. And again, we were with a host, and he says, "I've been hiking these trails for 16. I've never seen a Mississauga rattlesnake, but I actually have a photo of it. I should probably pop it up here for you. Beautiful little creature." So,
got this. Toronto is a Mohawk term meaning house of meeting.
It is indeed. I lived in Toronto for 5.5 years. Also discovered it now ranks as the fourth largest city in North America, right after Mexico City, New York, Los Angeles. So, 3 out of 10 Canadians live in the Toronto area. So it's a lot bigger than it was when I was a graduate student there. But what I was there for was to do some television interviews for Crossroads TV network. That's Canada's largest Christian network. And they have a show that they've had going for almost 30 years called 100 Huntley Street. So I was interviewed twice for that TV thing. And it was very encouraging for me in the sense that I was being interviewed in my book, A Matter of Days. And this is the fourth time I've been interviewed on kind of the subject of science and faith by that network. And when I was there 28 years ago, I was interviewed by the founder, who is very much into the young earth creationist position. And he was interviewing me about my book, The Fingerprint of God. And, it's really not on that subject at all. And so instead of talking about the book, he wanted to debate me on the age of the universe. And I kept trying to correct me on my astrophysics. So and I kept trying to diverge him from the debate, and it just wasn't working. So, but I got to meet that man. Hadn't seen him since that time. I'd been interviewed by his son just 2 years ago on Navigating Genesis. And after the interview, he came up to me and said, "My dad is young earth, and I've leaned that way all my life, but I got a whole bunch of questions." So he started firing questions at me. And we wound up attracting about 20 other staff people. So we had this two-hour meeting, at the end of which he said, "I'm really seeing how much stronger an evangelistic position you have from an old earth perspective. And he says, thank you for answering all my Bible questions. Well, I got to meet his dad this time, and thanks to the son, the dad has really, and he says, you know, I'm really looking forward to your new book, A Matter of Days, and how it can resolve this controversy, because this controversy needs to be resolved. And that's really what was new about the book. You know, it's a second edition, but it's unlike most second editions. It's got 75 new pages of content. I took a bunch of pages out, but it is a thicker book. And really, the second edition is all targeted. How can we get this thing resolved and move on to another church-splitting controversy that's got nothing to do with salvation? And, you know, that's a bit of a joke, but it's actually serious. And something I write about in the new edition, how God always blesses us with these church-splitting controversies. They've got nothing to do with salvation. Why? So we who are Christians can become exercised in the mission that God has given us, that you see outlined in 2 Corinthians 5, where he says of his followers, you're ministers for reconciliation. But how can we reconcile non-Christians to peace with God if we can't reconcile with one another? And therefore, the church has always been plagued with these splits and these controversies. But it's so the world can watch how we resolve our differences with one another, and they can see, what is it Jesus said, they'll know you're my disciples because of your love for one another. And the real test of your love for one another is how you do with things that are very divisive and controversial in your midst. So I especially want to thank the 13 Christian astronomers who evaluated the debate I did with Danny Faulkner. And they were commissioned to produce a statement along the lines of Acts 15. You know, that was really the first church-splitting controversy that had nothing to do with salvation. This idea that you had to be circumcised in order to be part of the church, and how that was resolved by having the principals present their views in front of the Jerusalem Council, and the Jerusalem Council sent out a statement. But I'll tell you something funny about the 13 evangelical astronomers that evaluated the television debate I did with Danny Faulkner. They produced a statement, literally, very quickly. Within 6 weeks, they had a statement. It was 41 pages long, not including citations to the academic literature. And I said, you know, if you look in Acts 15, the Jerusalem Council sent out a statement to the churches that was only two sentences long. Do you think you can condense this 41-page statement plus all the citations down to something like a page? And they said, only one page? It took them 18 months to edit it down to one page. But what they produce is very much in the spirit of Acts 15. And if you haven't seen it, it's in the book, but it's also up on our reasons.org website. It's one of the most gracious, but also very directive statement, kind of like what Acts 15 says, you know, this is what you must believe, but this is where we need to have charity with one another. And the graciousness of which these 13 astronomers wrote this out, I thought was very commendable. And actually, what I say in the second edition is, we need to use this example to deal with other church-splitting issues. You know, things like the role of women in the church and what we do with finances, elders, etc. There's lots of controversial issues. Probably one of the biggest ones, what do we do with the doctrine of hell? And and then the whole homosexual issue that has come up. Never mind transgenderism. So there's opportunities for us to actually use that as an example. But the best example, of course, there is in Acts 15. But what's interesting, too, about this, and by the way, had another long talk with the staff there at Crossroads afterwards, just following up on what happened 2 years ago, and just really seeing how much Crossroads wants to partner with Reasons to Believe. And what was fortuitous is literally the day before we got on the airplane, we had finished the first of the three sets we want to put up in a studio at our new facility. And it's ready to go. And so Crossroads says, as soon as you can start producing short, they want it short, 2 to 4 minutes, where we give them some amazing scientific discovery that gives stronger evidence for the Christian faith and really encourages people to use it. It's going to be a challenge for us to be able to do those kinds of things, but for the first time, we've got the facility to make it happen. And now we've got a network who really wants to get it out there. And what also is unique about Crossroads, their TV presence is much stronger in other languages than it is in English, particularly in Arabic and Farsi. So, and what's wonderful about the Reasons to Believe Toronto chapter, it's filled with people who are fluent in Arabic and Farsi. So we got a really good partnership beginning to develop there.
Is Spanish part of the Crossroads ministry too?
Yes, they do multiple languages, but they're particularly interested in partnering with us for Farsi and Arabic.
Oh.
Because they see the kind of content we have as having potential impact with the Islamic world. And it also helps that our staff biochemist was raised in an Islamic home. And you know how he came to Christ, how science brought him out of that background. So, but what was also interesting is that we did a second interview that had nothing to do with science faith issues. They found out that I'm on the autistic spectrum. I've got Asperger's syndrome. And they said, we get a lot of mail on this subject. And so they wound up doing a 20-minute interview on how do you deal with that. And I was kind of surprised in the interview because they said, you know, well, if you're a parent with a child that's on the spectrum and they're high functioning, how do you help them become better at socialization? And how do you find out, you know, what they're good at? And I said, well, the second part is pretty easy. What you do is you expose your 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old child to college-level material in different disciplines and see what excites them. And then you know what to encourage them in. And they said, well, did your parents do that? And I said, no, they didn't. But the elementary school I went to, when I was in grade 2, they took us on a tour of the Vancouver Public Library. And I've noticed something here in America. Public libraries tend to be more diversified with small collections. In Canada, it's different in that you have these public libraries with 4 or 5 million volumes. So they're really big libraries. And I remember, you know, at 7 years of age, going to the Vancouver Public Library, and they would only let me in the children's section. I wasn't allowed in the adult section. So, but I found, you know, I just kind of wandered around there, and I think this is something that works with people on the spectrum. Just turn them loose, they'll find something. And what I found was the stuff on physics and astronomy. Went home with 5 books, read all 5, went back the next Sunday, or next Saturday, and got 5 more. And within a few weeks, I'd read all the books in the children's section. They gave me a pass to the adult section. And then after that, they gave me a pass to the university library. So, I mean, that's kind of what you do to help these kids. And then they said, well, what about the social issues? So that's more challenging. You need to expose your child. I use the term neurotypical people. Those are people that got normal-type brains. And what you need to do is encourage your child to be trained by people who are not on the spectrum. And that's important because it's so easy for people on the spectrum to spend time with one another. I mean, just go to Caltech. One thing about astronomy, it has the highest percentage of people on the spectrum. And, you know, it's literally around 40%.
Do people on the spectrum have a tendency to just say things backwards? Like, I can say things backwards.
Well, that's something else I got to share in the interview, is that if this is not a disease, and not everyone is the same. In fact, one of the rules you have with people on the spectrum, everyone is different. And so therefore, there's no rule of thumb in how you help the individual. But one thing they all share in common is that they have great difficulty reading body language, reading emotions, or expressing emotions or body language. In fact, I've had several people in the class, visitors come here who are on the spectrum. Well, let me tell you what the most common question I get from someone who comes here to the class who's on the spectrum. How do you get a date with the opposite sex?
And you told him you have no idea?
But more or less, yeah. No, I shared with them the story of, you know, how I tried to get a date with Kathy. It took 2 years. And she was very interested in dating me, but couldn't figure out a way that I could understand that she was. And I was trying to get through to her, just getting nowhere. And overcome it by I wrote her a letter.
Do some people on the spectrum speak backwards?
Some do, but most do not. Well, I can tell you a joke about the astronomers at Caltech. It's like, you know, how do you tell when a Caltech astronomer is starting to experience dementia or Alzheimer's? Well, normally what you do with regular people, you ask them, what are the names of your children? What's your phone number? What day of the week it is? What hour of the day it is? Well, I can tell you, having been around these Caltech astrophysicists, they don't know the answers to those questions. Even when they have all their faculties. That was true of me. If somebody asked me what day of the week it was, I wouldn't know. I mean, it's like, you know, or what time of day it is. It's like, you know, that's just not important. Or my home phone number. Other people know my number. I don't have to know my number. So. But what they did is they developed a special test for them. They would ask them questions like, okay, can you write down the Navier-Stokes equation in polar coordinates? Now, that takes about a whole page. And if they can't do that, well, then they're suffering from dementia. So. But, no, seriously, just trying to help people saying, okay, you know, what's the big challenge is, and what really helped me was running into people who were willing to train me on, for example, how to look people in the eye. When I came to Caltech, I would talk to people but just by staring at the floor, which wasn't a problem because all the other astronomers were doing the same thing. We all thought we were normal, so the rest of the world is in trouble. But that was my advice. I mean, and that's one of the reasons why I think it's a bad idea to take all these people on the spectrum and put them in a special class, because now they're around people just like them, and they're not going to learn the social skills they need. They need to be around people that can help them get trained. And it takes time. You know, people come here and tell me, you know, I'm having trouble trying to get the interest of someone in the opposite sex. They say, well, you know, it's going to take a long time. And you've got to be willing to be trained by people who are, quote, neurotypical. And you have to be humble. Be willing to take sharp criticism. And that's one thing I appreciated about Kathy. She says, look, when you're going door-to-door evangelism, you can't just stare at the ground. You actually got to look at the person. And then she tried to help me with my public speaking, where she said, okay, you did great. You made eye contact, but with only one person for the entire hour. That doesn't work. You make that person very uncomfortable. Everybody else thinks you're ignoring them. So she helped me with that. And then next time she says, you know, you're great, you're looking at a lot of people, but your eyes are darting all over the place. So, and then when I finally would try to make good eye contact with people and do it the way neurotypical people would, I would forget my message. So, it's literally taken me decades to be able to stand in front of an audience like this and, you know, be able to have some kind of social contact and emotional contact without losing the place. Well, I already have lost my place. So. But it was a good interview in the sense that I think I was able to really encourage. And by the way, several of the employees told me they had children that were on the spectrum and really struggling, and they're trying to help them. And they said, we just never thought of the idea of exposing them to really advanced material in different areas and just seeing what really clicks. So they were excited. So that was good. So, by the way, one of the things that happened during that time is I said, okay, you started reading these books on physics and astronomy at 7 years of age. Did that have any impact in your eventually coming to Christ? And I said, well, interesting you mentioned that. The first book I read in cosmology was one by Fred Hoyle, Nature of the Universe. And it came out in the same year that I went to the library, saw the book, and grabbed it. And, you know, he's not a Christian. Fred Hoyle is probably best described as some kind of a Hindu agnostic. But I remember reading at age 7 where he talked about his anger and frustration towards Christianity. I mean, it is right there in the book. He's got several pages on why, you know, here he is in Britain, and it says, You know, this is quite a few years ago, how all these British people go to church. Well, now it's down to just 6%. But he said, you know, Christianity is an extremely frustrating religion because it tells you you're going to live forever. And he says, I can't imagine living forever. Maybe 300 years, but surely after 300 years, you're going to be totally bored. And, you know, the idea of being forced to live more than 300 years, he says, I just can't accept that. So that's why I reject Christianity. And but that kind of stuck with me in all the years of growing up. I mean, okay, because his whole point is, you know, after 300 years, I've been there, I've done that, what else is there to do? And I said, well, he's got a point. This planet is finite. There's only so many places you can visit, but, you know, there's some beautiful places I've been I don't mind going back to see. And the idea of being bored in just 300 years, but then it got me thinking, all right, if you don't believe that there's a God that loves you, if you don't believe that there is a God that really has created everything here, then it would get boring. And so that kind of caught me in my teenage years, just realizing Fred's got a point. Things can get really, and that was his whole idea. If you're forced to live more than 300 years, you basically run out of interesting things to do and interesting conversations to have. But that assumes that there is no God that you can relate to. If there is a God that you can relate to, that makes your relationships with human beings more fulfilling. In fact, I got to share that with the interview on the Asperger's syndrome, is that how different it was having Asperger's as a non-Christian and having Asperger's as a Christian. Because when I signed my name in the back of a Gideon Bible giving my life to Christ, I realized I was now committing myself to talk to people about the Christian faith and about, you know, being an evangelist to bring the faith in Christ. And I knew that that would mean I would have challenges. And so I said, I got to learn how to relate to people, because I knew I didn't have very good skills in that. And so I decided to become a public speaker for the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. And, you know, people said, well, why did you do that at that early of an age? I had to do something to figure out a way to relate to people so I could fulfill this commitment that I made in giving my life to Christ. And that really changed everything and made me willing to, you know, get help, because I would give these lectures and say, tell me how I can do better. And, boy, I got a lot of criticism. And also I share that with a lot of people and reasons to believe and want to speak, because that had to be terrifying for you being on the spectrum. I said, yes, it was. It was terrifying the first 300 times I did it. And then it just got scary after that. By the way, it's still scary, but it just takes practice. Okay, we are studying Proverbs 30. And, I got a whole bunch of science discoveries I was going to share with you, but maybe we better, because last time we didn't get too far in our lesson, so I really want to move along there.
Let's get to the lesson.
All right. Good idea. Proverbs 30, and for those of you that are new here, what we're doing is we're going through the entire Bible, looking at all the major creation texts in the Bible and seeing how what they say about creation, but also recognizing these major texts consistently link redemption with creation. And it's something we shared here in the class. When you look at the major creation texts in the Bible, what you recognize is that God's works of redemption precede his works of creation, and his works of creation are always in the context of redemption. Here in Proverbs 30, not the whole chapter is about science, faith, and creation issues, but there are three, four segments that give you these comparisons. You know, three things are amazing and four stands out. And we talked about the eagle in the sky, the snake on the rock, the ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. And if you missed last 2 weeks ago, this is where we had Kathy and Richard come up here and talk about this particular text. And I appreciate how many of you as couples have also come up here and just shared how courtship with human beings is very different than courtship with the highest animals. With the highest animals, it's basically the same ritual. There's no variety. and is relatively short-lived. With humans, it's very different. And each of these texts we run into in Proverbs 30 basically talks about three examples from the world of animals and then segues to what's different about us human beings. And when it talks about these animals, it's basically bringing up features of these animals that are impossible to explain without God. And so, you know, what about the eagle? And just the amazing challenge that the eagle has for any kind of Darwinian or naturalistic model. Well, we've done that. The part we're going to look at now is what you see in Proverbs 30, starting in verse 25. And here is talking about the little things that God creates. Ants are creatures of little strength, yet they store their food in the summer. Conies are creatures of little power, yet they make their home in the crags. Locusts have no king, yet they advance together in ranks. A lizard can be caught with a hand, and yet is found in kings' palaces. So notice here, it brings up the human context fourth, and then three earlier. I don't know how many of you went to the service last hour, but notice the service was about locusts. And here locusts show up. Now, the service before it was locusts in the context of Joel chapter 2. But what I found interesting is that just this week in the scientific literature, a paper was published on locusts. Basically, I think it really fits this text here, because what they were doing, you have these drones that go out, and they got little cameras fixed on them. They can drop bombs on terrorists, etc. Well, the research paper was discussing the challenge of, say, sending out 1,000 drones. And how do you get them not crashing into one another? You want to have a dense, because there's certain applications where you kind of want a dense flock of drones. And they're basically saying, you know, locusts can swarm, and yet they don't damage one another in flight. And the challenge of trying to program these drones that we make so that they don't crash into one another when they're in a dense swarm flying. And basically they're saying the locusts can do it, but we can't. We've yet to build drones with the appropriate hardware and software that they can swarm like locusts and not crash into one another. And the paper was making the point, hey, all we're trying to do is have drones that are several feet apart, never mind the locusts that are jammed tightly together. And they're just saying, there's something mysterious about the locusts we need to understand. And that's kind of what this text is all about. So, you know, locusts are small creatures. They're weak creatures. And yet, they can fly in formation with no king, no leader. And they don't have big brains. And this is kind of what's talking about ants, bees, insects. They can do these amazing social structures. How do they pull it off? And the scientific community is yet to answer that question. A lot of them think it's in the DNA, but they can't find where in the DNA you get the property that allows the bees, for example, to do all of their social hierarchy. Now, there's been some who've suggested that our social structure is just like that of the insects. But it's not. Because you look at the insects, it's highly programmed. You don't see variation. With humans, you get social, very advanced social structure, likewise with some of the higher animals, but you see variety, especially with us human beings. Our social structure can be reorganized into a very different kind very quickly. And that's because, you know, we do have these brains. It's not just a brain. We also have a mind and a spirit enables it to happen. But when you're talking about ants and locusts, bees, they don't have a mind, they don't have a spirit, their brains are extremely tiny, but they're able to pull us off. And yeah, the biological community is thinking it's got to be somewhere there in the DNA. And maybe it is, they just haven't found it. But I think what's interesting is now we human beings are trying to do the same thing with our machines that we see these insects doing. And, you know, this paper that was just got published is basically saying we're woefully behind what we see just in a locust. The fact that they can fly in tight formation, they don't have a king, they don't have a leader, and yet they're not destroying one another in flight. When we try to do it with drones, we see a lot of bad things happen. You send out 1,000 drones and a couple of hundred get destroyed. So, but with locusts, that doesn't happen. And so they're basically going back to the drawing board saying, we got to have better software. And, you know, it's not just trying to send them out there, because when you got wind, you got temperature, you might have humidity, and all this affects the flight patterns. And so they're basically saying, we have to build drones that can sense what the wind is, the temperature, the humidity, the air pressure, because all that is a factor in trying to get these things to fly in formation. And basically, it's a software nightmare trying to... Well, number one, it's a hardware nightmare, because you've got to put all these sensors on board all these craft. And, you know, these things are fairly big. They're about this size. And they say, you know, a locust is tiny. It's got all the sensors there. And yet, you know, here we are with something this big, and we're having trouble. Yeah.
Mass air formations of humans during World War II on all sides, during their raids, were able to have, you know, several hundred aircraft, up to 1,000 aircraft, and the collisions were very few. They weren't, you know, 10% or 20% of the aircraft.
Yeah, but that's because you had human beings on board the things flying them.
And you had to see your pants, your eyeballs, your
right,
your senses, and somewhere in the human being that capability also.
Well, that's the whole point. I mean, now you've got a human being in the aircraft that can make adjustments for the temperature, the wind, knows where the other craft are, they can make, yeah, and so they can fly in tight formation. And but it takes skill. You know, when you see these air shows where you got these fighter jets flying just a few feet apart, it takes a lot of practice, a lot of skill, and some really smart people on board with, you know, very sophisticated controls.
The wing and the gap between the wing and the tail of the other aircraft. Four of these guys flying along, doing all kinds of stuff up there, man.
Well, I mean, these really good air shows you see, they literally fly just 12 inches apart from one another. So that's how good it can get. But now, see, the challenge is this. Can we do that with a drone?
No.
Because now you've got to find some substitute for the human mind and the human body that's on board and make all that happen. Now, by the way, I'm not saying that this is impossible. I think if they put enough hardware technology and software technology in these things, they can probably get these things to fly and swarm like locusts. But really what it's going to demonstrate to us, somebody a whole lot smarter than these advanced aeronautical engineers is responsible for the behavior of locusts. This is not something we can attribute to a naturalistic process. And that's really the whole point of this text. Look at the behavior of the conies, the ants, the locusts, and what we see here is a profound challenge to a naturalistic explanation. We really do need the supernatural handiwork of God to explain it. And as smart as we are, as well-funded as we are, as technologically advanced as we are, we have yet to be able to duplicate it. Now, again, I think a time will come we can duplicate it, but it's just going to document how much better funded, how much smarter and better educated the creator of all these creatures were than us. Okay, you had a follow-up? Yes.
I was just thinking, instantly I thought of maybe there's a God-made proximity sensor. We have at least three, I think there's more than that, in the F-35 for different reasons. Its own missile coming back, other planes that it can tell proximity from several miles to several feet. But I imagine the hardware and software involved would still be difficult to make it in a drone.
Well, notice how big these fighter aircraft are today. I mean, it's not like World War II, where you had, you know, a craft that was maybe 20 feet long. Our fighter jets today are really big aircraft. And you got, I mean, you see the pilot in there, he's dwarfed by the size of the rest of the plane. Why is that the case? Because of all the technology they got to put in the plane in order for the plane to do what it does, where it can be controlled by one human being. So, I mean, I think they've calculated that just the copper wiring in a typical fighter jet is 3 miles long. So,
also, there was a lot of hope in Moore's Law, if you're familiar with.
Yeah.
But he you get, we're already at the point where quantum effects are beginning to affect the wiring. So.
Well, that's what's interesting about studies that are being done in these insects, is that you're really seeing a Moore's law in operation, how you've got this tiny creature with all of its capability, and you can't make the creature any smaller than what it is in order for it to be able to do its you know, capability. If you're not familiar with Moore's law, it's this idea that every couple of years we double our capability in computer capacity and computer capability. And that's been going on now for about 30 years. And we've been the beneficiaries of every 18 months. We can throw away our old computer and get one that's four times better. That's not going to last much longer. We're approaching the limitations of the laws of physics. And so there will come a day when you can keep your computer because there won't be bigger, better ones coming along. But what they're discovering, I think, is really interesting, that if we really want to approach the limitations, the greatest thing we can do in trying to push Moore's law, we're probably going to have to emulate the brain. Because this is where, I mean, what they're really realizing is that the human brain has the greatest computational capability that you can squeeze into something that weighs only 3 pounds. So, and you say, well, why not make it bigger? I mean, you've seen these science fiction movies where they've got these aliens with these gigantic heads. I kind of laugh when I see that because it's not taking into account that, yes, the human brain is phenomenal in what it can do with just 3 pounds of mass. But if you were to make it 4 pounds of mass, it kills itself. There's a limitation on how big you can make the brain be in terms of the body size. Because for all of you here in this room, 35% of your blood flow supports your brain. And if you were to make that greater, then the brain cooks itself to death. And so it's important that the brain, relative to the body size, not be too big. So yeah, this idea we're going to evolve into these things with these huge heads can't happen. Not with our laws of physics, yes. I didn't quite catch that. What's not possible?
I was just going to say, unless we have the circulation that could support immense brain tissue growth, but given the types of problems that we're discovering in the human species when it comes to our blood, we probably won't really have that development.
Well, what's interesting about human anatomy is just how everything is focusing on trying to get our brain maximally functional. And so what's unique about the human body, one, we're bipedal, and we're slim, tall, and we got this amazing circulation system, an amazing perspiration system. It's all designed to keep us cool enough that the brain can function. So if you weren't able to sweat as efficiently as you can sweat, you wouldn't be able to sustain a brain-to-body mass as big as what you see in the human species. So, and that gives us certain advantages over other creatures.
Hothead?
Yeah, well, I don't know what I shared with you before, but there's research that actually shows that early humanity was able to outcompete the big predators by the fact that we took advantage of our ability to keep our bodies cool when it's very hot. So, for example, if you go to Africa, what you notice with the really big predators, they nap during the hot part of the day under a shady tree or a shady rock. And you know, early humans in Africa recognize we don't have to be afraid of the lions or the hyenas or the cheetahs if we hunt between, say, 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. And what they would do is they would prepare their hunting area with ostrich eggs. And they would basically put a little hole in the ostrich eggs, get all the egg stuff out, and then they would fill up with water. You know, and an ostrich egg will hold more than a liter of water. And so they would literally put these ostrich eggs all around their hunting area and then wait till it got really hot. And then they would start chasing the prey. Now, A human being can run 25 miles an hour, but not for very long. If you want to be able to run for a long time, you've got to drop that below 20 miles an hour, about 18 miles an hour. Well, guess how fast the antelope can run? 40 miles an hour. However, an antelope cannot run 40 miles an hour for a very long period of time in the hottest part of the day. And so that's how early humans would be able to hunt big game. They would basically have water all over the place, and they would just say, we're not going to be able to catch these animals, but we can keep them moving. And the idea is they would keep the prey moving to a point where they basically collapse from heat exhaustion. Then the humans would be able to take care of the prey. That was their food. So, and they didn't have to worry about the lions and tigers because, you know, they were all trying to take a nap underneath a tree. But that's just because we have this, such an amazing perspiration system, and the fact that we're not hairy. And so our lack of hair means that we can dissipate heat efficiently to our environment. And as long as we've got lots of water to drink, we're great. By the way, there's one other animal who has an amazing perspiration system, and that's the horse. And because of that, humans and horses were able to bond, and we were able to use horses as transportation animals. And horses are great, but you've got to give them a lot of water. So anyway, we're a little off topic because we were talking about the little stuff. The ants. And again, you know, you look at the ant culture, and what makes them get all this food and store it up for the winter? And by the way, this goes back to my childhood. I remember when I was 9 years of age, in our backyard, we had this red ant colony and this black ant colony. These little tiny ants, we're talking only like 3 or 4 millimeters, little tiny ants. But there was one afternoon I was in my parents' backyard, and what I saw was a battle between the red ant colony and the black ant colony. And what's interesting about the black ants, they seemed to have a bigger army, and they basically came out in a block like this and moved towards red ants. The red ants, on the other hand, what they did is they formed a relatively narrow block like this and then two flanks. And then, even though there weren't as many red ants as the black ants, they were actually doing better because the black ants were all bunched up and the red ants actually had more combat contact because of the way they flanked. Now, I remember looking at that as a child saying, how do these ants develop that kind of military strategy? I mean, they don't have big brains, and what is it that would cause them to do that? And, you know, why would they actually have these rather pitched battles like that? And, you know, you could figure, well, you know, one ant colony is competing with another ant colony, and so they're both competing for a food supply. But this kind of military-type battle that they're engaging in, what's going on there? And by the way, I did an experiment. My parents said I was doing experiments since I was 2. But what I would do is I would see this battle going on, and I would start interfering, basically killing ants. And I wanted to see what would happen. Well, what would happen is that the black ants basically kind of stayed put. They held their ground. The red ants dispersed and reformed. So I said, what is it that's allowing them to do that? The fact that they would, you know, disperse from the danger, but having dispersed, and I stopped killing the ants. And basically I saw them reset up their formation again. So what's going on there? I thought, are red ants smarter than black ants? I don't know. But again, I think it's making this point here. We see behavior in these very tiny creatures that really defy any kind of naturalistic explanation. Is this in the DNA? Maybe. But nobody's been able to find it yet. And also I think what's interesting, as you read the literature on this, it's like literally every month that goes by, we're discovering another feature of these little tiny creatures that we haven't been able to figure out before. It mentions conies. Everybody know what conies are? If you ever climb high mountains, you know what conies are. There's these little tiny rodent creatures. But you can be up at 14, 15, 16,000 feet, and these creatures live there. And the amazing thing is, they're tiny. And you say, how are they able to survive under those conditions? Because the thing about being a mammal and being that small is you lose a lot of body heat, and it's cold up there. I mean, even in the summertime, it's cold because they got to withstand the night. You ever been up at high altitude and you spend the night at high altitude? The temperature plummets. The temperature can plummet 60, 80 degrees. So it can be hot in the daytime, and at night it drops down to zero. And these little creatures somehow survive. And that's kind of the point it's bringing up here. These conies survive in the high crags. And how do we know that they survive? They got little power. And basically they're just eating whatever they can find up there. And you say, what do they eat up there? Because, you know, if you go to these high altitudes, it looks like there's nothing to eat. There's no grass, there's no flowers, there's no seeds, but there are lichens. And, you know, the idea that you can kind of survive off the lichens. By the way, there's quite a set of different mammals that actually can survive on lichens. But, boy, they've got to have to eat a lot of those lichens in order to keep their body warm. And the crags, actually, what the conies do is they live up in these high mountains, usually pretty steep places, and that's so that they can protect themselves from prey. Because after all, they're predatory birds that can fly to those high altitudes, and they like to eat these conies. But the conies, as they scamper around, what you notice, they always have an escape route. Because when you're at those kind of elevations, you're basically dealing with loose rock. Why? Because you've got freezing conditions and hot conditions, and that cracks the rocks. So it means there's always some little crevice where this little tiny rodent can escape. So for a predatory bird comes over, they can find a way down one of these tunnels. And, you know, I've tried to photograph these creatures. They're hard to photograph because they'll kind of come out and they'll look at you and squawk at you. But the moment you get your camera out, they're back down in their little crag. And it just seems to be their behavior. Well, what's really going on here is they're making sure that they got an escape route whenever there's any kind of threat, so they never get very far away from their escape route. And by the way, I've been up in some of these mountains where you can actually hear them scurrying around several feet below you, because you're on these kind of things where there's this cracked rock, and it just creates all these little tunnels that they can run around in. And I think that's probably, too, how they're able to keep themselves warm, because they get sufficiently below the surface and find a little tight spot where they can get their body in there and keep themselves warm. But as it says here in the text, you wouldn't expect to find mammals at those high altitudes under those severe conditions, but they're there, and they're tiny animals. And that's the least thing you would expect, because the smaller the mammal, the more subject it is to hyperthermia. And these creatures don't have a lot of fur on them. I mean, if you've ever seen these conies, they have just very short hair, and yet somehow they're able to survive at those high altitudes. Then last of all, the text talks about the lizard, and talks about the lizard being in the homes of even kings. Well, here in Southern California, I'll bet you anyone who's lived here more than a year, you've had a lizard in your house. We've had several lizards come into our house. Anybody ever had a problem with a lizard? Okay.
I have a cat that brings them.
Yeah, our cat has presented us with a few lizards as well. So, but here it's making the point they're easy to catch, and yet we can't keep them out of our homes. They just seem to be everywhere. And I can tell you a story, too. This is when I was at the Owens Valley Radio Observatory. And you know, we had three telescopes there. There's about 10 telescopes there now. But I was there by myself. And that's, by the way, it was a good thing I was on the Asperger's syndrome, because they gave me 41 days of observing time where I had no contact with human beings for those 41 days. I did fine. So people who are neurotypical would go crazy under those circumstances. But I got some amazing observations. But one thing interrupted my observations. Suddenly, because I was connecting these three telescopes, and the connection failed. And I said, what's going on? And so I thought, well, maybe something happened to one of the cables. And, you know, we had a problem with the cows, because cows love polyethylene. It's not good for them, but for some reason they love the flavor of polyethylene. So I thought, well, probably a cow has bit through one of my cables out there. Went up there and checked all the above ground cables, and they're all fine, and the cows weren't around, but the telescopes still weren't working. And so I had to go down into the underground cable box, and it's about like this, but like this. So I was crawling down, checking all the cables, and I got a couple hundred yards down, and there was this lizard feeding on the insulation. And that was the problem. Okay, so I knew it was a problem, but now how am I going to get that lizard out? And that took a better part of a day, because I realized, the lizard's there, and when I tried to get him, he would just back up. And, I'm in his tight spot. He's very comfortable in a tight spot, I'm not. So that was an entire day just trying to get that one lizard out of there.
How did you get him?
Well, I had to leave and figure I got to get some kind of net, and I'm going to have to get some kind of bait. So I eventually was able to get him in the net and then get him out. And then I thought, well, what if he's got a friend? I mean, but fortunately, I was able to repair the cable and everything worked fine for the rest of the time. So, but I think this is a good example. I mean, these critters can get into amazing tight spots, and they can do things that are pretty harmful. And yet, quote, it says here, you can catch them with a hand, but trying to keep them out of things there. And also, I think what is making the point here, last of all, a lizard can be caught with a hand, yet it is found in king's palaces. When it's talking about the king's palace, and by the way, we're going to run into a king in the next segment of 3+4, is that it's referring to someone who's got great power and capability. And says even the king, with all of his resources, cannot live in a home that's free of lizards. And it's basically making the point, as great as we human beings are, we're not as great as we think we are. We can't even control the ants. I mean, we talk about lizards. We're moving into a hot time. I don't know what it's like with you, but whenever it gets really hot in our neighborhood, we get ants invading our home. And by the way, it's not really so much they're looking for food, they're looking for water. And so, if you put water outside, it often can prevent the problem. But yeah, as sophisticated as we are here in Southern California with all of our resources and technology, we can't even keep our homes free of ants, let alone the termites. Okay, so, I mean, that's kind of the big problem living here in Southern California. You always got to deal with termites. But that's kind of making the point here, is that as great as we human beings are, even these little creatures present a profound challenge to us human beings.
Yeah, pest controls make a lot of money.
They do. But, here's this tiny ant, here's this tiny locust, here's this big, powerful human being with all of his intellect and technology and capability, and what can we do? The ant wins, the locust wins. I mean, you heard that in the sermon this morning,
yeah.
Is that when a locust swarm comes, there's really nothing you can do about it, except wait for the locusts to eat one another, and that'll be the end of the swarm. But meanwhile, all of your crops are gone. All of your grass is gone. All that's left is dirt. And so, as powerful as we human beings are, we can't even deal with that issue. And now we're trying to duplicate that with our machines, and we're discovering, wow, we're not as powerful as we thought we were. And that's really the message you see throughout here in Proverbs 30. Look at these amazing creatures that God has created, and be humbled by what you see, realizing, hey, okay, we're the epitome of God's creation here on earth, but hey, look what these little creatures can do. Yes?
I'm surprised that Fred Hoyle's assertion that in 300 years he'd be bored, being a scientist, and then reading this about all that there is to discover, and just to realize, it almost is like Michelson, who up on Mount Wilson, he was given the first Nobel Prize for a U.S. scientist. But he's the fellow who said, we've discovered everything, and all we have to do now is just to find measurement to greater precision. But yet, it's his greater precision that allowed Einstein to come along with relativity, and thus, Michelson got a Nobel Prize for it. Yet, Hoyle didn't catch on that that there are greater things. Neither did Michelson.
Well, that's more common than what you might think, Steve, in the sense that, there's a book put out by John Horgan, which is basically titled The End of Scientific Discovery. And it seems like every generation of scientists, and these are people coming from a non-theistic perspective, so I think the fact that they don't believe in God is coloring the way they look at the natural world. They look at it as finite, and therefore we're going to come to the end of our ability to scientifically explore. And so just like at the end of the 19th century, you had all these scientists saying, all that's left is engineering. We've done all the science that can possibly be done. Here we are at the end of the 20th century, beginning of the 21st century, and we've got this coterie of scientists drawing the same conclusion. We've come to the limits, and we're not going to be able to make any more progress other than doing a little bit of engineering. And actually, if you read the history of science, that's been going on for more than a millennium. But what's interesting is who's driving this idea that science is soon going to be exhausted. Now,
atheists.
Well, again, from a Christian perspective, you realize there's more than just the physical world out there. And, how are we going to be able to exhaust everything when we have no idea what's going on with the mind? I'll give you an example. In my office, I got about 40 books on consciousness written by non-theists, and they're all trying to figure out where consciousness comes from. The one common thing in all these books, they end the book by saying, "We have no idea." But they're all looking for a naturalistic explanation of consciousness at an animal level and at a human level, and they say, even at the animal level, we have no idea where it comes from. It's a mystery. Well, it's a mystery if you're stuck to thinking biology and physics provides us with all the answers. And I think that's probably what you're getting at, Steve. If you had this mindset that biology and physics is all there is, then yeah, there's going to be a limit to science. Like Moore's Law, there's going to be a time we can't make computers any faster, any smaller, any more capable. We're going to run up against the laws of physics. And likewise, given our human capabilities, we're going to run into the end of physics and biology. But what if there's more than just physics and biology? Yeah, go ahead.
What surprises me, especially about Michelson, was that he came to the conclusion that we only have to measure to greater orders of precision because everything's discovered. Yes, these are, it's almost like maybe, and this will be a blanket statement, so it's not completely fair, that Christianity and the awe of God really drives science.
Well, what's interesting is that science was stillborn in every culture except Christianity. Because you see, and I think science is something that motivates every human being. We're all born as scientists, but only from a Christian worldview was it not still born. Now, when I say that, you can look in places like India and China and Egypt. They had bursts of science, but it couldn't be sustained to develop a scientific revolution like it did, say, in Reformation Europe. Reformation Europe is where you really have the birth of the scientific revolution, and it was a Christian worldview that made that happen. Yeah, John.
Well, regarding living more than 300 years, I think the atheists come from the perspective of living life as it is now for 300 years. So I've often asked the question to see what they're thinking is, which would you prefer, to live forever the way things are now, or to eventually cease to exist? And a lot of them seem to believe that they'd rather just not cease existing if they had a choice.
Well, that was Fred's point.
To know what the possibilities are for truly fulfilling lives that's always been endlessly exciting and interesting and joyful.
Yeah, I mean, from a Christian perspective, we have an eternal destiny that we're pursuing. And we realize that the new creation, we're not just going to be sitting on clouds playing harps. We're going to have careers there. They're going to be far more fulfilling than any career we've had here. But Fred's whole point was, after 300 years, I'm going to be totally bored. And my wish, if there is a God, is that he would stuff me out of existence. I don't want to live with him for the rest of eternity. I'd rather he just snuff me out of existence. Because after 300 years, it's just going to be boredom from there on in. That's what he described Christianity as. Christianity is an eternity of boredom. But that's not Christianity. So, but I'll tell you, as a 7-year-old, that got me thinking, is Christianity really an eternity of boredom? And took another decade before I really began to pursue that, yes. Well, I think this is what's different about humans, is that we do have this sense of a beauty. I mean, when I take our dog for a walk, I don't think he's getting all excited about the beauty around him. He's wanting to see if he can sniff out some food or whatever, or meet another dog. And what we see in these tiny animals really does, we call it instinct, that the bees have this instinct, the ants have this instinct to store up food. You know, bees have this instinct to be able to efficiently collect their nectar, but it looks very much like a programmed behavior in the sense that it never changes, it never diversifies. With humans, we also have this high social organization, but it's adaptable, and it's something we can design and redesign for different circumstances. And so this is why scientists are looking at DNA, because the DNA really looks like computer code. And since the behavior we're observing looks like it's programmed, it's got to be in the DNA. But as much as we know about the DNA of these insect creatures, we've not been able to find where these instinctual behaviors arise. It could be it's in the DNA. It's a logical place to look. But the fact is, after all these decades, we have yet to figure it out. And maybe it's not there. I mean, that's kind of the mystery. People are saying maybe it's somewhere else, and if that's the case, we haven't got a clue. Yes.
But as President pointed out, we're learning that there's instructions all over the place.
Yes.
Not just in DNA.
It's not just in the DNA, correct. So, hidden information.
Like where?
Well, I mean, that's kind of what these people are speculating. If it's not in the DNA, we've got no clue where it could be. So DNA is your most information intense, and it's stable. I mean, so that's the reasonable place to look, because of all the information coding molecules we see in life, DNA is the one that's the most stable. And since this behavior seems incredibly stable, they say reasonably that's where it's got to be. But again, they've not been able to pin it down and say this is the gene that does this. So maybe they will. I mean, they're working on it. But the whole point is, this is a profound challenge. I mean, why would these little tiny creatures have this amazing social structure? If it's all programmed, who's the programmer? The idea that nature would spontaneously produce this without the handiwork of God, really, that's why it's here in the text. This is something, even without all of our technology today, would force you to conclude God's got to be responsible for the way these creatures behave. Just like with the eyes of an eagle. The eyes of an eagle really can't be explained apart from the handiwork of a creator or the way of a snake on a rock. I mean, how would you ever expect these creatures to be able to move like they do without legs from a Darwinian perspective? It's not something you'd ever expect to be a product of naturalistic evolution, let alone the way of a man with a maiden, okay? We discussed here a few weeks ago. Yes. All right. Okay.
I guess the reason why I asked about the idea of God origin aesthetic is because, especially from a creative standpoint, I'm actually an artist, and I'm curious if it's possible, in the same way that meditating on God and God's word can bring light to His truth and the sort of overarching universal truth that that if it's possible to find a sort of an artistic truth, like what truly is beautiful by God's standards.
Well, let me put it this way. From a naturalistic perspective, why do we have all this amazing variety of taste in food and texture? And why do we have this amazing color and beauty that we see in the naturalistic world? I mean, there was no God. Wouldn't we expect all food to taste like cardboard and to look like cardboard? But it doesn't. And so just the fact that, and where do we get our ability to appreciate beauty? I mean, not only did God make the world beautiful, He created us in such a way to appreciate that beauty and express our appreciation for the beauty. Where does that come from if you're trying to explain this all through some Darwinian mechanism? It doesn't have a survival value. And what's interesting too about us humans, we will sacrifice our well-being to appreciate beauty. I mean, what is it that motivates people to go to these exotic, beautiful places in the world that are dangerous? It's because of their desire to experience that aesthetic beauty. Or what is it that motivates someone like you to depart from, say, I don't know what job you have, but, you know, engineering, medicine, and you go into art? I mean, I have a son who's a professional artist. And it's like, he's got amazing ability in academics, but he eschews academics. Wants nothing to do with it. He wants to spend all of his time in art. And he says, I'm prepared to live like a pauper in order to be able to spend my time doing this. Now, how do you explain that from a Darwinian perspective? Some being able to, quote, give up the good life in order that they could, quote, focus on beauty. But that's very easily explained by a God who enjoys beauty and creates beauty. And by the way, a theologian I knew, Thomas Torrance, he told me that he went around the world speaking to different departments of physics and departments of mathematics. And he had this message where he basically challenged the unbelieving mathematicians and physicists, where he said, how do you explain the fact that mathematics is optimally beautiful? I mean, the first lecture I got as a physics undergrad, my professor of physics said, here's a tip that'll help you to be maximally successful in your career as a physicist. The right answer is always the most beautiful equation. Look for beauty in the equation, and that will be the right answer. Well, it raises an obvious theological question. Why is the most elegant and beautiful equation always the right answer? Unless there's a God that really enjoys and appreciates beauty and elegance. So even at the level of higher mathematics, we see that principle. It may explain why so many mathematicians also are musicians. There seems to be a link there. You had a question?
Oh, no. I was doing it on her behalf.
You're doing it on her behalf.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for doing that. Okay, I see I'm out of time, so we'll get back together next week, and hopefully we can finish this chapter and jump into Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is loaded with a lot of neat content, so particularly about the way God structured the laws of physics. So let me bow in prayer. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this amazing era in which we live, where we can see our brilliant scientists struggling with these issues, trying to explain what you have created and trying to explain it apart from you, but realizing they're coming up short. Father, I pray that in the process they would realize that there really is a God, a powerful God that's created all this, and a God that wants good things for each human being that comes to him. So, Lord, I pray that you make each one of us effective in being a witness for you, to point people to the one that really did create all of this for our benefit and our enjoyment. We thank you, Lord, that the entire universe that you created was all designed so we can fulfill our destiny here on earth and also in the new creation. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.